Greetings and transmutations, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this April 2011 Science News Update. I'm your host for this evening of phenomenal scientific hearsay and rumor, Jim Campanella. Excuse me for the transmutation comment. I have now watched and or listened to about 15 episodes of the updated anime Full Metal Alchemist Brotherhood while working in the lab this week, and I have a serious monkey on my back. Wow, what a show. I highly recommend this one to you if you're a fantasy or science fiction fan. This new adaptation sticks very closely to the manga, unlike the original show, and it is simply blowing me away in terms of drama, action, and mystery. At some points, it almost plays out like a fantasy animated version of the now-extinct Fox Drama 24. Anyway, enough of these random thoughts. Let's get on with science. First story of the night. A new antibiotic is on the horizon, and it is being developed by IBM, of all companies. When I first read the story, I adjusted my glasses to assure myself that what I was seeing was correct. And yes, it was. IBM. And no, we are not talking about nanites or any other kind of robotic antibiotic. IBM is really developing the real stuff. What is very cool is that their new antibiotic overcomes bacteria that appear to be resistant to lots of other antibiotics. IBM is on a promising new track to kill off those unkillable strains. Thousands of people a year develop life-threatening staph infections resistant to multiple antibiotics, and it takes only about 10 or 20 years for microbes to develop resistance to traditional antibiotics that target a particular metabolic pathway inside the cell. Dr. James Hedrick, a materials scientist at IBM's Almaden lab in San Jose, California, has just published an account of their new drug in the latest issue of Nature Chemistry. Hedrick's new drug is a specially designed nanoparticle that kills bacteria by poking holes in them. His group hopes that the microbes will be less likely to develop resistance to this revolutionary type of drug because it is not a drug in the strict sense and physically pokes holes in the cell membrane. And no, again, this is not a little tiny robot poking holes in the membrane. This is not the first time that drugs of this type have been tried out. There has been little success in clinical trials in the past. They were either ineffective in their killing because of the complex milieu of the animal body, or worse, the particles were toxic and killed animal cells in addition to the pathogens. Hedrick says, quote, "We're trying to generate polymers that interact with microbes in a very different way than traditional antibiotics," unquote. To do this, Hedrick's research group took advantage of a library of polymer building blocks that IBM owns that can be mixed and matched to make new complex nanoparticles. To make a nanoparticle that would selectively attack bacterial membranes and then break down harmlessly in the body, they put together two types of building blocks. First, at the center of the polymer sequence is a backbone element that's water-soluble and tailored to interact with bacterial membranes. Second, at either end of the backbone is a hydrophobic sequence, which doesn't like water and doesn't deal well with water. When a small amount of these polymer chains are added to water, the differences between the ends and the middle of the sequence drive the polymers to self-assemble into spherical nanoparticles whose shell is entirely made up of the part that will interact with the bacterial cells. IBM researchers say this new drug can be injected intravenously to treat people with life-threatening infections, or can even be made into a gel that can be applied directly to wounds to prevent infection. IBM has three problems that need to be overcome right now with this drug, as far as I can see. The first problem IBM has is safety. Initial tests of the IBM particles with human blood cells in live mice have been promising. And Hedrick says in the article the nanoparticles didn't interact with human cells because their electrical charge is significantly greater than that of bacterial cells. Also, there were no signs of toxicity in the mice injected with the particles, and none of them died. I, however, would sleep more soundly knowing that something as potentially pernicious as these particles are highly tested. IBM's second problem is the same one that was faced when penicillin was first discovered. There's simply not enough of it around, really, to do any serious clinical testing. The IBM group is working on making larger quantities of the polymers, scaling up from the current couple of gram capacity to kilogram quantities needed for larger clinical tests. IBM's third problem is that they are not a drug company, and apparently they have no intentions of becoming a drug company. Hedrick says that they plan on partnering with a healthcare company to license the polymer drugs. The geeky side of me was a bit disappointed to read that I wouldn't be able to take antibiotics in the future labeled IBM. The thought of that is just kind of cool somehow and appeals to the old hacker inside me. Oh well, whatever. The next story is kind of related to a discussion I had with my students in my medical genetics class last week. We were discussing immunogenetics. Just as that sounds, it's genetics that deals with the immunological system. If you don't know, in your immune system, there's a special type of white blood cell called a macrophage, which basically is a microscopic soldier for the body. It wanders around, and a lot like the blob from the old movie, engulfs any kind of invader, be that viral, bacterial, or even fungal. Once an invader is engulfed, the macrophage has the ability to activate other parts of the immune system, like the T cells, and alert them to a potential invasion. Actually quite cool. One of the other cool things that macrophages can do is follow a chemical trail and actually track down the source of an infection at a wound site. The cells can travel huge distances through the body to do this. The process of following a chemical trail is called chemotaxis. If the macrophages do not have that chemotactic ability or lose it, then you will be very sick. In my genetics class, we were actually talking about a rare genetic disease called Chediak-Higashi syndrome, which, by the way, sounds like something out of Star Trek, but is a real childhood genetic disease. Kids who have this problem have these symptoms. They have immune deficiency, partial albinism, they bruise easily, they have a very low platelet count, which explains the bruising, and they have recurrent infections. And among this whole series of serious problems, the children's macrophages have impaired chemotaxis, which reduces the quality of their immune responses quite a bit. The disease is fatal in childhood, usually because of infections which cannot be fought off by the affected child. Few patients live to adulthood. The ones who do survive the infections have a progressive neurologic breakdown, which is also part of the syndrome. Not particularly pleasant at all. Anyway, that is not the topic here. The topic here is actually how cool macrophages are when they're actually working. Mathematical biologist Dr. Andy Reynolds of the Rothamsted Research Institute in Harpenden, England, has been examining just how amazing macrophages are at traveling to infected wound sites. And apparently these cells have abilities that are astounding at solving an age-old mathematical problem called the traveling salesman problem. The traveling salesman problem is simply, how do you mathematically calculate the shortest routes to travel to a series of cities that are separated by many miles? Using a computer and linear programming, you can find a lower boundary to these problems. The lower boundary is a distance the minimum route can't be shorter than, and then that can be a guide to search for the shortest route. Routes that have 1,000 cities or fewer can be easily solved using this computer method, but when you add more than 1,000 cities to your route, the number of calculations required to find the shortest path increases exponentially. Worse, scientists still don't have one clean algorithm that can crunch the numbers, no matter how many cities, and find the shortest route. In fact, researchers don't even know if such a solution is even out there or exists. The Clay Mathematics Institute in Boston offers $1 million to anybody who can come up with a solution or prove that it doesn't exist. Well, apparently, macrophages are masters of the minimum route. They use the follow-your-nose strategy of chemotaxis to create these routes. Reynolds' paper indicates that an immune cell seeking 5 different targets will find a perfect traveling salesman route every time. With 10 targets, the cells are still pretty efficient. On average, their routes were only 12% longer than the shortest possible route. These routes were comparable to the solutions calculated by a computer algorithm. Reynolds says that, quote, macrophages taking advantage of chemotaxis is a nice example of when the suboptimal becomes optimal. I'm not entirely sure what he means by that. I'm not a mathematician. I think he's implying that the cells are making the best of a bad situation and taking whatever advantage they can. In this case, they're finding the bacteria by that faint chemical plume they leave behind, and not just doing a comprehensive search. Onward and upward? Well, how about downward? Here's a story from the bottom of the ocean. I remember learning the word sessile when I was still in grade school. It was one of those words that just stuck with me for years and never really got forgotten, just because it's such a useful word. I remember calling one of my roommates in college a pointless sessile organism when I found that he had not left the couch one entire Saturday. He just stared at me and narrowed his eyes in response. I was not even entirely sure he knew what I meant. Anyway, If your memory is failing, as mine is as I'm growing older, sessile refers to any organism that is rooted to one spot and doesn't move around. Sponges and trees and bushes are sessile. The problem with being sessile is one of protection. How do you protect yourself from being eaten when you cannot just run away? The sea cucumber, which is not a cucumber at all, but an echinoderm, has perfected one method of protection. As Dr. Patrick Flamong from the University of Mons in France discussed in the latest issue of the Journal of Experimental Biology. Now, as Flamong explains, sea cucumbers already are pretty well protected. They come equipped with Cuvierian tubules. These allow the animal to expel sticky threads that ensnare hapless predators which dare attack the poor little guy. They also have mutable collagenous tissue which allows them to stiffen or soften their body for protection, sort of like internal hardening armor. But Flamong says that sea cucumbers also have an additional protection. Put simply, they taste bad. Remember when your mom made you suck on a bar of soap for saying dirty words? Well, sea cucumbers produce the same stuff that makes soap taste so bad. Detergent molecules called saponin. Yes, sea cucumbers taste like Lifebuoy. Flamong wanted to see just how effective these chemicals were, so he took samples of the sea cucumber's body wall and extracted and purified their saponins. Then his research group analyzed the saponins with mass spectrometry and found 8 different types in the animal's body wall. Flamong then used an innovative mass spectrometry imaging technique to identify the location of each saponin in the sea cucumber's body wall. Together they found 6 of the saponins in the body wall's outer layer and 2 in the inner layer. The team also analyzed the saponin distribution on the body walls of mildly stressed cucumbers after they'd been poked and found that it changed. Flamong suspects that the smaller saponins in the epidermis of the relaxed sea cucumbers are converted into the larger, more subtle saponins for release into the water when the animals are stressed. Having analyzed the sea cucumber's saponin distribution, the Frenchman decided to find out how the animals use the compounds for defense. Collecting seawater surrounding relaxed and stressed cucumbers, he extracted saponin from the water and found that the relaxed animals released 1 saponin, while the stressed sea cucumbers released 6 different ones, 2 of which were new and could not have come from the sea cucumber's body wall, but presumably somewhere else in the body. Finally, Flamong decided to find out what the saponins did to fish. He had a small quantity of the compounds, similar to the amounts released by the sea cucumbers, to an aquarium with Mediterranean rainbow wrasse and oscillated wrasse. And he noted that the fish began breathing heavily, quote-unquote, and racing around the tank. By the way, I have no idea what it means when a fish breathes heavily. Anyway, the fish soon settled down and none of them died. Flamong suspects that fish can smell the unpleasant-tasting compounds and give the sea cucumbers a wide berth to avoid getting a bad taste in their mouths, much as humans avoid annoying co-workers when they see them coming. Several different people have emailed me about this next story, so I guess, well, I'm obligated to actually report on it, although I suspect you've already read about it in your newspaper headlines. A couple of weeks ago in the journal Nature, it was reported by Dr. Takahiko Ogawa of Yokohama City University in Japan that his lab, for the first time, was able to produce sperm cells in cell culture conditions, or in a petri dish, as the newspapers reported. By the way, cell culture has not been done in a petri dish for the last 30 or 40 years, but that's beside the point. Ogawa, a professor of urology, and his colleagues in Japan took small biopsies of testes tissue from baby mice that contained spermatogonial stem cells, but no mature sperm. The mice were too young to be producing any sperm. Ogawa then simulated the natural environment of the testes by suspending the fragments on a semi-solid media support and partially bathing them in liquid. Weirdly, the formulation that he used is usually employed in cultures of embryonic stem cells to keep them in their undifferentiated state, not to cause them to differentiate. Here, Ogawa discovered that this media had the opposite effect, encouraging spermatogonia to differentiate into mature sperm. Ogawa said, quote, "We have not yet identified the key factors in this media which really helped our system. My next challenge is to identify those factors and make an even better culture media to improve sperm quality and make it applicable to other animals. While the sperm counts produced were relatively low in culture, they were functional, the sperm cells, that is. Ogawa inseminated adult mice with the cultured sperm and found they were able to produce pups that in turn were able to mate naturally. He said, quote, "The final evaluation of sperm functionality was to make offspring and see the healthiness of that offspring. I'm still keeping the offspring, and they are about 14 months old, and they look very normal, comparable to other mice," unquote. The full health consequences in the animals produced from in vitro sperm remains to be seen. The problem is, when cells differentiate into sperm, major changes occur in their DNA that make those cells vulnerable to environmental factors of all sorts. Depending on what is in the surrounding environment, factors could affect a cell's DNA, creating defects that could be passed on for future generations. Again, this is from Ogawa, quote, "We don't know the long-term consequences or the transgenerational effects, but as a model system, this is fantastic. It gives us the opportunity to start looking at things in an in vitro setting and specifically alter and dissect cells in a much easier manner. It's a great step forward," unquote. The ability to generate sperm cells like this could be a major boon to infertile men or non-sperm-producing prepubescent males that face radiation treatment for cancer. Unlike adults, kids cannot produce sperm and have it frozen away to be used after the ravages of the cancer treatment. Culture-produced cells could help those boys produce their own offspring years later, despite the effects of those cancer treatments. The last story of the evening involves enlightenment. Okay, that was a really bad pun. We know from lots of Jacques Cousteau specials, as well as movies like Finding Nemo, that there are lots of organisms at the bottom of the oceans that create their own light. Dazzling squid, graceful jellyfish, and radiant fish use bioluminescence to attract mates, detect prey, camouflage themselves, or just deter predators. As I said, we've all seen examples of these extraordinary adaptations to transmit light in open ocean species, but it's interesting that organisms much closer to the ocean surface that don't live in deep open water seem to have these abilities as well. The tidal pool living, thumbnail-sized cluster-winged snail is known to be among these luminous surface creatures. But the mechanism behind its brilliant light production was a mystery, and why it produces the light at all has been a complete mystery until now as well. Now, doctors Dimitri Dehane and Narita Wilson at the Scripps Institute of Oceanography at UC San Diego have examined what is going on with the clusterwink in a paper published last month in the Proceedings of the Royal Society. The researchers first caught the tiny snails on the beaches of eastern Australia, where they are native, and cluster among rocks and tidal pools. The duo then transported their catch to the laboratory to quantify the snails' emitted light. First, they stimulated the snails to produce light using chemicals, and within seconds, the clusterwink emitted a brilliant, radiant, blue-green light from an area of its body incapable of extending beyond its shell, so it was inside of the shell. Next, they placed the snails with other animals to find out what provoked their light display. The snails produced their highest quality light levels when they encountered species that they contacted frequently. The team then placed the snails with actively swimming frogs and lizards, providing ample opportunity for physical interaction. Physical contact did trigger intense light displays from the snails. As the source of light cannot extend beyond the snail's opaque and pigmented shell, the authors then characterized how the shell transmitted and actually diffused this brilliant light. They found that despite its hardiness, the shell transmits most wavelengths of light, with the exception of the blue-green peak of the snail's bioluminescence. However, when blue-green light is shown into the shell, mimicking natural bioluminescence, it scatters to parts of the shell not directly exposed to the source, allowing regions of the shell that are not directly illuminated to glow. They also found that the wavelength of light is not altered by the pigment or opacity of the shell, in contrast to other bioluminescent organisms that do alter the light's color. The clusterwink shell also transmits light incredibly effectively for how thick it is. Its efficiency is 8 times higher than any equivalent commercially available diffuser. Although high transmittance is usually associated with low diffusion in materials, the shell's biomaterial retains a remarkable capacity to diffuse light, In fact, the blue-green glow projects over the entire shell an area 10 times larger than that of commercial diffusers would. The authors believe that this property co-evolved with the snail's luminous capacity, as the shells of closely related non-bioluminescent species do not diffuse or transmit light at all. This is the first account of a calcified structure that diffuses and enlarges biologically produced light. Dehane and Wilson say that this structure may provide inspiration in constructing the next generation of light-transmitting materials and optical devices. However, the take-home message that these two researchers got from the cluster wink is that their shells provide an exceptional defense tactic, that is, to produce an intense and enlarged flash of light to deter predators while offering shelter to the resident within. Not bad for such a tiny creature. Well, that's all for me from now. As always, take care, stay away from any dinners that include sea cucumbers, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.